sounds, it actually sounds like it could be a really huge show.
Yeah, it's a really important piece of being in biodiesel production. And what's a problem is glycerin cocktail. It's not just glycerin. There's methanol, right? Our excess methanol, excess catalyst. We've got other components from the vegetable oil that are in there. And that means that it's maybe at best 50% pure. And we really need to be up into the 80% purity range, which just requires another process and some more tanks and some more energy to do. And so what happens usually is people get started making fuel, they neglect that piece of it and start saving it up and saving it up. And it comes pretty quickly. All of a sudden we've got a lot of glycerin on our hands. And then we start looking towards refining it to a higher level of purity. So I think the right way to do it, and I've made this mistake already a couple times, is to build a plant without a means of refining the glycerin. So we've been working hard for the past over six months, designing and building a little biorefinery to purify that glycerin.
That's why we can't get our wash tank. Their welders are all busy doing their biorefinery.
Yeah, so we are so excited to get this thing online, and it's very close.
One of the other things that, if you look at biodiesel, there's just not enough of it out there. So the value of biodiesel is as an additive, and particularly its lubricity factor. When they pulled sulfur out of diesel, it lost its lubricity. And so they've been adding all these petroleum additives to improve lubricity, its ability to flow in the engine. And really, its best value would be as an additive in diesel at some percent, 5% or whatever. But there's no mandate at this point. But
as low as 1%.
Yeah, as low as 1% would improve the characteristics of diesel in the engine, improve the performance of diesel engines. And some states are actually moving towards a B5 mandate. I think Massachusetts just passed a law for that.
Getting back to the issue of policy and restaurant vegetable oil, does anyone here know very much about the San Francisco policy and how we could get such a policy here and what the process was? And are there other cities that are requiring restaurants to recycle their oil? Do you know?
Every city requires oil recycling at this point. You know, you can't just dump it anywhere, and because there is a market for it, they usually don't. But there's still cases where people illegally dump. In the case of San Francisco, it's not a requirement, but the city is involved in collecting the oil and actually using it to produce biodiesel for the local municipality and their trucks and things like that. So it's not so much a requirement, but they're really doing an excellent job of marketing and getting the message out, and they've got the infrastructure where they can collect the oil. I don't know how well it's going at this point, how much oil they're getting, if it's making a dent, how many restaurants are participating at this point. The next step would be that actually a law is passed saying that they actually require to, say, donate their oil or sell their oil. One of the things that we're seeing is that the oil value is going up and people are actually starting to pay for it and give the restaurants money. And we're seeing that incrementally rise as the demand and the price of all these different petroleum-based and petroleum-connected feedstocks go up.
Which makes it harder for folks like you trying to get the oil for free. Steve, and then you.
Thanks. When we're talking about policy, and obviously biodiesel is going to be a limited resource forever, then we want to be able to use that biodiesel as efficiently as possible. What do y'all think about limiting some kind of policy which limited the use of biodiesel to public transportation rather than a private car?
I don't know. I guess
that would kill us. Basically,
It would just switch. So it's a big picture question. And
there are public fleets that use it.
We've got Carborough and Chapel Hill. Use it. I mean, a lot of the cities around here, but the so I guess it yeah, what's its highest use is the question. And I'm not sure if school buses is the highest use. It might be because of...
I really think that school buses is a good place because of the children and their how they're, as they're developing their lung systems and their exposure level to pollutants.
If you look at
the impact, the bang for the buck, I think that's absolutely probably the best place for bodies. So if we're going to mandate it, it should go into school buses. School buses are really inefficient, though. I mean, we got school buses that are like 2 miles per gallon or something ridiculous, 5 miles per gallon. They could have diesel hybrid systems. They're starting to make them now. But you know, the whole issue of how the government and the private sector to work, if we sold all of our fuel that we made to the government right now, we wouldn't make nearly as much as we do selling it retail to all of these really nice VW TDIs and the folks who are really the comprise our co-op. And right now we need as much money as we possibly can get for our fuel. But if we lock into selling it to a municipality, they're going to want it as dirt cheap as they possibly can because they have no money, first of all. And that they basically require all of the vendors to achieve, only a 10% margin or something along those lines. So, as much as that's a good idea, we were like, maybe next year, so.
And at the end of the day, if you've got 500 million gallons of biodiesel, and it'll be consumed, here or there. It's the big picture. As far as the planet is concerned, it doesn't matter where it gets used.
In response to Stephen's question, my response is, well, there really is no public transportation system in this area. I mean, extremely minimal. So I can't go anywhere. I can't leave my house. I can't get out of my town. I can't go anywhere public transportation. And that, to me, is the problem. That it's not the limited biodiesel, because biodiesel, as we've just been talking about, is only sort of like a little stopgap. A much more major problem is that there's no public transportation in this system. And
there is a limited amount.
That's why you couldn't come to build my little Cobb cottages. And to me, there's no public transportation. You call it limited, I call it zero.
What about the data buses? Do they use any batteries in Durham?
They have. City of Durham and the County of Durham have, at times, these batteries. And I don't know where they are right now. They might be at a V5 blend, I think they went as much as V20. They might be off of it again. Duke was on biodiesel and had a V20 blend for a little while, and they got some bad fuel, and then they went off it. So it's catch as catch can, and the two major providers of biodiesel to the municipalities in this area are Potter Oil out east and then World Energy down in Charlotte. And they are providing pretty much the majority and buying and selling it into that municipality, city, county market.
My point is that I would, as long as you're bringing up public transportation systems, that hasn't really come up so far in this discussion, whereas I think that it needs to be the first point of discussion. I think that we need to have a much more developed rail system, for instance, in the United States. I think that we need a much more developed bus system in the United States. Bikes, of course, local. I mean, there needs to be a system of transportation in the United States that makes sense, because just thinking that biodiesel is the solution and trying to plug it in makes no sense to me, and I make biodiesel all day long. That's what I do. And as far as policy stuff, that's this discussion. As far as the San Francisco model, what's going on with that? Just somebody asked the question. Yes, what's going on with San Francisco is that they had a problem with grease stopping up their drains, and so as a policy decision, what they decided to do was that their inspectors for the grease traps. Grease traps are all restaurants need to have something to prevent grease from entering into the drainage system, just in case, when you're washing out your pots and pans, it doesn't go in. So when these inspectors now go around and inspect restaurants, they say, oh, you have nice grease trap, looks good. Oh, by the way, what do you do with your used fryer oil? And they say, oh, it goes out to Baker, whoever picks it up. And they say, well, we'll take it, or there's this biodiesel plant or whatever. There's some advantages and disadvantages of it. It's kind of strong-arming, in a sense, their access to the grease. So if you love big government, then you're psyched. If you're, you know, somewhat anti-government, you're not so psyched, but that's what's going on. And then, hold on, and then I'll hand it back to you. And then as far, when we're on the policy discussion layer, there are other models, by the way, of policy that can make sense. Leaf's a big proponent of the Portland, Oregon model, which I don't know, do you want to talk about that? Because you probably know more about it than I do.
Yeah, the Portland model is, I think it would have a really, really neat impact here. What they're doing in Portland is if they've got some policy at the state level that works between farmers and biodiesel producers. And so they've got an incentive which offers farmers a little bit more than market rate for certain types of crops which they believe to be appropriate and sustainable for biodiesel in the state. So they're appropriate to the bioregion. And then they've got a little incentive to the biodiesel producer which allows them to buy the oil derived from those crops a little bit below market. And we're talking about pennies, but it's a really big deal when you're in the production world, with whether you're a farmer and you're producing, you know, for those markets, or you're a biodiesel producer producing for whatever your market is. And so that has been really successful program, and it's created really, I think, the coolest model in the country right now of really locally produced fuel, where they're growing the crops that the oil is coming from. What I would like to see here is that model, only where we do the oil leasing program. And we've got beautiful virgin oil, which goes and gets used in restaurants. Of course, some of it disappears because that fried food sucks up a lot of it. And then we take back what's left and turn that into biodiesel. The other piece that makes it so successful is that the state also has a renewable fuel standard, which the RFS is a requirement to burn a certain percentage of renewable fuels in their public fleets. That is not really enforced. It hasn't really been phased in. So the city of Portland passed their own law, and they said anything within the city limits must be a minimum of 20% biodiesel. And they phased it in over the course of 6 months or something, 2%, 5%, 10%, 20%, so that everyone had some time to get into it. And they created the market. So how it happens practically is there's one cooperative of farmers who also does the crushing and the oil extraction, and there's one biodiesel producer who buys the oil from them. And of course, the farmers use all the feed to go to their cattle, and then the biodiesel producer sells it to the petroleum distributor, who sells it to the city of Portland. And that whole loop is working really nicely.
That's sweet.
Now, that's something that I've been down to Raleigh, like my first session of lobbying was this year. And it is really hard to make laws, it turns out. So I've been trying to do some really small, simple stuff, and have learned a lot, met a lot of people, and started to build relationships. But I can just imagine what a challenge it was to get those type of policies in place. And that's a big project to do here. We need a very broad base of support. And I don't think we're there. I don't think we have the base of support that we need to pass legislation like that today.
Doug.
I'd like you to talk a little bit about what our air quality story is. Why did Portland do this? Did they do it for air quality issues, or did they do it to get a little bit off of petroleum? But what is the story about our biodiesel versus commercial diesel from an air quality standpoint?
Well, there was a relationship there, and there are also separate questions. From an air quality perspective, biodiesel has a lot less harmful emissions. We don't, for instance, have, and this is a nitty-gritty conversation about emissions, and I don't want to bore people who don't have that technical bent, but there's, from a carbon perspective, which is really important in this day and age, whenever you combust anything, you're going to make CO2. You're going to emit and release carbon. What's nice about biofuels, biodiesel or ethanol for that matter, is that it's coming from crops that need CO2,
sequester CO2,
right? They need CO2 to grow. So they're sucking it out of the air to build up their mass, and that causes a really dramatic, what's the number, 78% reduction in CO2 emissions. We have no sulfur, the volatile organic compounds, the carcinogenic compounds are just all knocked down to such low levels that the EPA requires testing of fuels. And when biodiesel went through its required testing, one of the things is to expose lab rats to copious amounts of this exhaust. And every fuel that EPA has ever tested has killed the rats at some point and caused genetic mutations and all this. And with the biodiesel, never killed the rats. So the experiment went on and on and on and on, and it was costing so much to keep running it that they finally decided, look, we're going to stop it because it's clear that this is not going to kill them in any remotely reasonable amount of time.
Made them stronger.
I don't know about that.
I believe they had to kill the rats after the experiment.
I wasn't going to share that. That's the downer side of it. They did have to kill them because they need to do autopsies on every rat to see what the effects are. And the rats turned out to be clean. So that's to air emissions. In terms of why Portland did it, Portland is really more sophisticated than North Carolina and most other states in the country when it comes to renewables and sustainability. And they did a really sophisticated analysis, and you can download the report off of their website, which is a good read, where they looked at what it would take, what would a future, a more sustainable renewable energy future in that state look like. And so they laid this whole thing out, and then they looked at what steps would be required, and then they laid out policy ideas. And they looked at the economic impact, and it's a tremendous report. Something that we only dream about here.
Too, the idea of that, you know, if you support local industry, you know, energy is huge. If you look at the value of the amount of energy that we consume, and most of it flees the state, if you promote that energy consumption and production here within the state, you're going to, you know, create jobs. You're going to have massive multipliers. It's really great public policy. But I think the question is where are the choke points? Where do you put the pressure? And you know, Portland was a leader in Oregon as a state, and I probably imagine they dragged the state along to a certain extent. So the question is, can we get Carrboro and Chapel Hill and Durham and Raleigh to fight each other to become greener and have better, more sustainable policies? And can Durham, Chapel Hill, and Raleigh drag the state into this move towards a green economy? And could that possibly happen from a policy development standpoint?
Just wanted to comment that we've got a harder battle to fight policy-wise. One of the interesting things about Oregon is the Willamette Valley, where Portland is located, has about 90% of the population, and Portland has about half of that. So they basically control almost a majority in the state legislature just in Metro Portland, which makes it much easier to drag the rest of the state than Carrboro or Chapel Hill have.
We're almost out of time, so we're going to do one last question.
This was just a quick follow-up on that. You talked about emissions. What about particulates? You didn't mention particulates, especially respirable particulates. How they're different, or are they, between biodiesel and...
Yeah, that's what I was referring to with carcinogens. Those are the PM, the particulate matter. And I don't remember the exact number. Maybe one of you guys remembers.
30%? No, it's...
It's a tremendous reduction in PM. There's the EPA's numbers. If you go to the biodiesel.org, the EPA's numbers are in their little frequently asked questions
section. Yeah, I got a flyer coming out of my tailpipe. I mean, I see it looks the same, but it's not.
Yeah, there's a really simple test too. I mean, it's not analytical chemistry, but You take a white napkin or paper towel and hold it up to the tailpipe, and do one with diesel fuel and one with biodiesel, and you'll notice that one is full of black particulate soot and one is not.
Particulate size is also extremely important for the particulate emissions, is what we're learning too from EPA's research. Anyway, well, thanks so much for coming out.
Why don't we continue in just informal conversations, but before we break up, I wanted to ask your opinion and let you know about the next event we're planning here. What we want to do is a screening of blood and oil. This was Sue Sturgis' recommendation from the former independent writer. And we've gotten hold of the DVD, and it's a new film. You may be aware of Michael Clare, who has done a great deal of research on U.S. foreign policy and oil. He wrote a book by the same title. So the film has just come out, and so what I'm proposing, and it hasn't been advertised yet, so it's not fixed in stone, is a screening on August 27th, which is also Wednesday night. We don't have to stick with Wednesdays, but that's when NC Power Down has always been in Carrboro. So that's why we chose it. And Stan Goff and Don Nonini and Steve Wren have agreed to be on a panel to discuss the film. The film is about 55 minutes. So we can actually talk about, sort of fit it into a larger perspective on U.S. policy and imperialism and oil. I might try and get another peak oil person. Does that sound like a good date, or does anyone have a big objection to Wednesdays? Or input on that? Thoughts about nights you would prefer? Wednesday's cool? We can keep you know, talking about it at each event and adjusting to suit people. We'll put that on your schedule, pencil it in. I will send you out a meetup invite announcement probably in the next day or two about it. And we're still looking for one more panelist, so if you have in mind somebody, please pass them along to me. I'll also email all of you who said you aren't on the NC Power Down list and give you the link so you can join if you want to. And also, we'll ask Leif to pass to me some of the connections, the websites for Piedmont and Carolina Biodiesel, obviously, but also some of those reports you mentioned, so that you'll have the option if you want to track that down. And if any of you would be interested in forming a committee to work on community-supported energy, including oil, but maybe not limited to vegetable oil, I think this is a good nucleus to start it in Durham. Pittsboro has this act together. Durham does not. So we've got a lot of work to do.
Sure. Hey, everybody. My name is Matt Rudolph. I'm the executive director of the co-op side of things at Piedmont Biofuels. And I just wanted to put it out there that we've got an internship program. It's a semester long, so it sort of goes spring, fall, and summer, more or less. And we still got one more spot available for the fall, so if you or someone you know might be interested in jumping in both feet into biodiesel, it's a full-time type job where you get a stipend, there's living quarters, you live and breathe biodiesel all day long and go out to events like this, and you're just fully in it. And it's not just biodiesel, that's the focus, but it's a lot of sustainability stuff around it, renewable energy, all that kind of stuff. So I'm just trying to get the message out. If you know somebody, most of the interns are typically like just outside of college age, or in generally, that's not a fixed rule, but that's the type of folks oftentimes that we get. Thanks.
Any other announcements? Okay.
There's a biodiesel workshop co-sponsored by Solar Energy International and Piedmont Biofuels, October 13th to 17th down in Pittsboro, and there's flyers on the table. And then the next week there is a grid-tied photovoltaics Solar Energy International workshop, and I'll be one of the teachers at that. But they're really, really awesome week-long workshops, and there's a bunch of flyers over there.
Also, Rebecca and Steve will be talking about their book, The Carbon Free Home, next Monday night? No, Monday after next?
August 11th at the Clean Energy Durham meeting.
And
do you want to make an announcement too?
Oh, I just want to say real quick that I've gotten involved in this other venture with trying to start a new cooperative grocery here in Durham. So if anybody, I have a bunch of flyers back there that tells more about it. We have a website. It's called Durham Central Market. We've incorporated and we're starting our founders membership drive.
They're $100 each, and we really need people to, yeah, lifetime, you get the money back if you want, you know, when you leave, all that kind of thing. We're trying to open up in downtown Durham somewhere, so just to give you a heads up about that. Thanks a lot.
One more answer.
I just want to, just taking off what Rebecca said, I'm one of the instructors for the SCI biodiesel course. It's me and Rachel Burton. And so we've actually got two biodiesel workshops coming up. One's just a weekend long thing. That's September 12th and 13th, and the October workshop is a 5-day. That's an intensive, like, really, really, that covers industrial commercial production stuff, lab fuel quality, all of that kind of stuff.
It's a great class. I took 2 years ago with that, and it was valuable.
So,
and look where you are today.
So there's two classes. There's just a 2-day introductory, nothing more than introductory, and then there's the 5-day comprehensive.